Broadly Britain, how Britain has resolved everyday problems from dog fouling to double parking. How do British pavements remain free of dog mess? Why are paths not littered with cigarette butts or road not lined with abandoned cars? What does the decline of the public lavatory say about the British? And is the natural reputation for queuing still deserved today? Looking at this and other top topics is Audley Britain. It is by Tim Newbern and Andrew Ward. Delighted to be joining me live on the line in an Audley queue, we would hope. Tim Newbern, Tim, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
How are you doing today?
Doing very well. Very orderly, thank you.
Very orderly. The British and queues and pavements and keeping things clean. And are the British a civilised society? Is this a particularly British trait, do you think?
So, yes and no, in that order, I think. I think, generally speaking, it's a pretty civilised society, but I don't think that's, in one sense, to say anything terribly special. Same would be said of Spain or France or Portugal or Italy. Is it peculiarly British? No, I don't think so. But I think what the book tries to deal with is some pretty kind of offbeat topics as a way of saying looking at how our world's changed in the last 40 or 50 years or so. And I think the word civility is quite a good one, because that's one of the ways and one of the kind of lenses through which I think you can see quite a few of these things, including kind of dog fouling and parking and all the rest of it. But the queuing example is a good one. The queuing somehow or other is a conceit. It's an idea that somehow the British are particularly prone to queue, and also they like to think, and this is a typically British thing, particularly good at it. As I say, I think both of those things are a conceit, but they have kind of historic origins, and that's largely in the kind of in and around the Second World War, and restrictions on foodstuffs and so on, when queuing became a kind of fact of daily life for women in particular. And it was something picked up in politics around the time, became a kind of contest. You know, the political parties used the queue as a sort of negative symbol of things going wrong. And from that time onwards, we've never really shaken off the idea that somehow there's something very specifically British about it. But I think there's evidence all around us that that's not so.
If you think about it, even our protests are orderly. If you think of, 1968 and France basically in turmoil with student rebellion, etc., and the Italians like to have a bit of, and the Greeks like a bit to have a bit of public disorder. But in Britain, by and large, we don't tend to have those large sort of unruly demonstrations. I mean, we'll have a protest, but it will be, in an orderly way.
Well, I mean, historically, we used to have an awful lot of it. You know, in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, we had tons of the kinds of demonstrations that you described. But the 20th century changed, and we changed, and it's partly through the kind of changes to the nature of British society and the kind of, just to get sort of more serious for a second, the sort of incorporation of people into the body politics during the 20th century. The latter end of the 20th century, some of that's broken down, I think. You see a lot more, or one did see, much of it's illegal now, but, a lot more protests around industrial disputes and riots and so forth. But, it's probably my academic career. I'm an academic by background. Some of it has been focused on the study of riots, and it's partly that which provoked elements of this book. Because the interesting thing about riots, we had huge ones in England, almost exactly to the day, 11 years ago now, the most significant riots of the post-war period, absolutely huge, terrible devastation, loss of life, and so forth. And I think most people studying it and talking about it, with the exception of a few politicians, would point to, among other things, the kind of underlying social conditions as being important factors in why those riots occurred. But the reality of these things, of course, is that if you looked at those social conditions over the last 10, 11 years and asked whether they'd improved, The answer, I think, generally speaking, would be no, they haven't. And that arguably, for many people, they've got worse. Mm. And yet we don't have riots, just as you're saying. Actually, fundamentally, it takes an awful lot for people to take to the streets. We are fundamentally an orderly people.
And interestingly, because you said the whole thing about sort of post-war Britain. And so if we have pre-war Britain, there's an empire and people know their place. And so things like the Peterloo massacre notwithstanding, you know, we have the empire, which is growing and everything is good. And you know, God bless Victoria, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have austerity, like you say, in the 50s. And then the 60s, you never have it so good. So there isn't a lot of... So there's a reason for keeping up the status quo, if you will, because it seems to be, despite Conservative Party sort of Labour isn't working posters, which again featured a queue, you know, it does seem to be working at that point.
Well, I mean, I think it's rather than it working in the sense of people are doing okay. You know, we live in a world at the moment. You know, modern Britain is one in which people are not doing okay by and large. You know, huge sections of the population in real, real trouble. And yet, as you were saying, you know, just earlier, they don't take to the streets. Actually, fundamentally, you know, we have learned over a long period of time to generally kind of, you know, be respectful of others, to follow general rules and regulations, to keep to expected patterns of conduct, whether that be in relation to, you know, queues or dog fouling or parking our cars and all the rest of it. And that tells us something really fundamentally important. You know, a lot of people would think that was somehow, you know, a consequence of the law or policing or punishment and so on. But it's not. It's not that those things don't have some impact. They do, of course. But it's fundamentally because we order and manage ourselves. We're self-controlling and self-governing.
And where does that come from, then? Is there an inherent decency, perhaps, that is installed in us from an early age?
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends how you see the world. I think, you know, crudely, philosophers see the world in two different ways, I think. And on the one hand, there's the sort of Thomas Hobbes view of the world, which says that, you know, unless people are very, very carefully managed, we'll end up in what he called a war of all against war, or all against all. And on the other side of the fence, there are a whole bunch of folk who would actually see us as fundamentally, you know, people in search of, you know, we seek and we need order. The social glue, informal social control, is the thing that sustains us. You know, we go about our daily business, whatever it is, driving on the right side of the road, not stealing from shops, respecting each other's public space, queuing for goods, picking up after our dogs, and all the rest of it. And we do it not because we think we're going to be punished, but because that's what maintains a broadly civilized society. And luckily for us, we want that, and most people respect it most of the time. And in a sense, the book's about that, but it's also about the kind of changing ways in which we do those things.
Isn't that? Do you at any point bring in the great sort of shopping trolley thing with the whole thing about returning a shopping trolley to its original place is perhaps one of the benchmarks of a civilized society, because there is no great penalty if you don't, but it creates a real pain in the watsits if you do just leave them lying around the car park.
Sadly, I don't, and maybe there's a case for a second volume. But
on that premise, yes.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of topics I can think of that aren't covered. But, I mean, it's an interesting one, the shopping trolley. I mean, and again, I think that my surmise is it follows the same broad pattern, which is to say, most of the time, actually, we respect those rules. We get a shopping trolley, we take it back to the little park outside the supermarket, the little area where they're kept, and the next person picks it up. But not everyone can be trusted to do that. Mm. And some of the time, you know, it requires a pound or a euro to persuade people that they need to take things back. And there's that thing of in I was going to say Britain, and I don't know how widespread it is. England, certainly, I won't say anything about the Welsh or the Scots here.
Probably best not to.
There's that very visible reminder that a small minority of people will just wander off of these things. And it raises the question of, what is it about shopping trolleys and canals?
Yes, indeed.
To which I don't know the answer.
I think it's the visceral thrill, or perhaps it's an evolutionary thing, that we wish to return to bodies of water, but we can't. And so, therefore, the shopping trolley is de facto a substitute for our own evolutionary wills. What do you think?
It's a good idea. It's the closest that the impoverished can get to a quick ride in a boat.
And if you've ever been close to any of the canals around the Manchester area I used to be, they are as close to the primeval ooze and slime as you could possibly get from which we sprung, allegedly. A lot of people would say that, well, not a lot of people, it's undisputable fact that the society and fabric of Britain has changed immensely from those Edwardian, Victorian, quote-unquote golden age, with the Second World War, the shrinking of empire, and the makeup, and I'm going to use a W word in a minute, and multicultural and woke Britain has changed society. Well, I have to put a warning in, because people will be throwing things at their wirelesses, you know. Do you think this has had an impact on Britishness? Or, in fact, have the people from those far-flung outposts of empire actually brought more British values back to the UK than perhaps the English has had themselves?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I accept the kind of terms of the premise.
Right.
In the sense that, you know, we have always been, a nation of imports. Few of us historically originated in these islands.
Indeed.
And so that construct of Britishness, that thing that we hark back to, was itself an amalgam of other cultures. Our royal family would be, you know, a very good illustration of that.
God in Himmel, etc.
But the question you raise is about, you know, we clearly are a more variegated, multicultural society now than we were 50 years ago. There's been the immigration on a very significant scale from parts of the world that had seen much less prior to that. Well, and what has that done? Well, I think what it does is it adds complexity to the values of the country, but more particularly, I think it adds a perceived complexity. I think we are less different from our forebears than many would see us, depending on how you want to portray these things. But I think the basic social values and ethics of the society in which we live are still broadly held, and that's the thing that I think I talked about as the sort of social glue earlier on. But there are a variety of ways in which I think, you know, one of the reasons for writing the book in the way that I did was that there's an awful lot of miserabilism around, sort of what historians call declinism. You know, we're going to hell in a handbasket. Everything's getting worse. What a terrible time we live in. What awful people we are. You know, you only have to look at the Brits abroad, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it's not that I want to deny some of that there aren't problems and there aren't some things that we would look at and say, well, that's maybe not as good as it once was or the way that it once was. But the interesting story of orderly Britain, I think, is that it's an extraordinarily positive one. It's one of social improvement, notwithstanding all the difficulties that we are now, you know, our streets in this country aren't, you know, I grew up in 1960s Liverpool. And you couldn't walk the streets for dog mess. It was, and you know, heaven help a poor mum with a pram and all the rest of it. It was ghastly. But we don't have that now. You know, I mean, it's not that you never see it, but yeah. Actually we've changed as a people. You know, we wander around wielding, those who have pets, and seemingly most people now do, wander around wielding bags, picking up this stuff and putting it in bins most of the time. It's a small illustration of a very big, of a quiet social revolution and a social good, I think.
One of the things that I've been, for my pains, I write columns in local press in Spain. And one of the things that we have, especially for the immigrant / expat community over here, is the fact that in Spain we never had, and you will remember this because there was the Keep Britain Tidy campaign. If you remember it correctly, every child in the 60s and 70s, you know, ran around not being a litter bug, etc. And I think the great Rory Hudd was litter bug at the time, and they never had that in Spain. And blimey, O'Reilly, is it as apparent? Because if you walk down the side of a road in Spain, you will see the aforementioned dog mess plus stuff out of windows. I mean, people will literally empty their car ashtrays in the street here. And if you did that in Liverpool, even if you did it in New Brighton, for example, you would be chastised, I think is the word. And yet, so there isn't, you know, it is an orderly society.
Well, yes, yeah. I mean, and so I'd say sort of two things about that in sort of reverse order in the ways you were describing. The first, you used the word chastise. I think you're absolutely right. And it's you would be likely to be chastised. And that is the reason that such campaigns were successful. It's that they helped to change public attitudes, and changed public attitudes led to different social expectations, so that we now expect people to pick up after dogs and to not throw litter out of cars. It's not that you won't see them doing it, but it's, you know, it is there's much less of it than there would have been if we didn't have this sort of generalized social expectation about our conduct. But I think the other thing I'd say would be, and I'm trying to think of a good example. I was in Spain not so long ago, and if only I'd been paying more attention. I'm sure you could reverse the example, that you could see things in Spain where social expectations have led to forms of conduct which are observed in ways in which they're not in England. Mm. You know, so there's a kind of cultural variation here. Some things we do, however, what word you want to use, better in some places than in others, but it's not a marker of our civilization. It's not as if the English are somehow more civilized than the Spanish or vice versa.
Interesting you should say that, because that comes on very neatly to my next point, because of the pandemic. Because in Spain, during lockdown, we had a severe lockdown, I think you could say. You couldn't leave the house, basically. Forget about going for exercise at the beginning of it. I mean, you were allowed to go to the shops and that was it, and you had to be back quickly. In the UK, we watched on our, you know, via our social media, by our TV, by our news reports, and to see people sort of being asked, you know, politely by, not even policemen, but whatever, what do they call them, special constables, to please move along, and you couldn't even put your sandwich there. Whilst in Spain, you would have been met with a, you know, if you were lucky, a battening. So that's, I suppose, do you think that the situation, quote unquote, that we experienced over the past 2 years, put that to the test about how orderly or otherwise the Britons were?
Absolutely, massively. I mean, I think all the things that we look at in the book, you know, the dogs and drinking and smoking and queuing and all the rest of it, they're everyday things, many of which have changed and changed quite slowly. But it all sort of led to the question of, well, what about a sudden shock to the system? How would we, if something dramatic happened, how would we cope? And the pandemic was, as you imply, this amazing natural experiment. I mean, awful natural experiment, in which for a couple of years at least, our world has turned upside down. All the things that we assumed we could do, we were no longer allowed to do. We were told in incredibly fine detail, albeit so some of our leaders didn't quite seem to understand their own rules, what we could do at which time, and so forth. The remarkable story, though, is that we complied. The what you see in England, and I suspect in most parts of the world, is extraordinary compliance with these sets of changes. People did stay indoors. People didn't go to work. People, you know, didn't go to funerals or birthday parties or see grandparents and children, all the rest of it. The most remarkable sacrifices were made. Now, the second thing there, I think, is, and it kind of gets to the contrast that you were perhaps raising, and I'd be interested to know more about this. We went through a period in the UK in which there was a lot of kerfuffle about what the police were and weren't supposed to do and how they were responding to all this. I mean, the reality was they were between a rock and a hard place, really, in the sense that when rules change very quickly, it's very, very difficult for the police to know what to do. And they got themselves into all sorts of hot water before they kind of realized that sort of, by and large, minimal intervention was generally the best way to go. Because more maximal, you know, heavy-handed stuff just leads to anger on the part of citizens and greater chances of pushback. And the sort of more laissez-faire approach enables people, I think, by and large, to take charge of themselves. Leaving the sort of, you know, whatever, the more worrisome or egregious breaking of the rules to be dealt with by the authorities. But it was a remarkable tale of all the things that I think apply to these other areas, which is we are, under the right circumstances and given reasonable direction and using formal means to symbolize and signal what we are and aren't allowed to do, we're remarkably self-governing.
This is just, this is in from Rob over at Rowan Records down over in that there London, who's saying the British like rules. Between the Walls was the best example of how British society was structured and everyone knew their role. We still have the hangover from this and we witness a high level of compliance to the general written and unwritten rules. Quite remarkable. That's what Rob's come in with on the WhatsApp.
I'm sorry, I missed a little bit of that. The volume's gone.
I would say the British like rules. Between the Wars was the best example of how British society was structured and everyone knew their role. We still have the hangover from this and we witness a high level of compliance to the general written and unwritten rules.
Yeah, well, yes, no. I mean, I'm going to do the classic academic thing of agree and disagree simultaneously. I mean, It's one's not a product of the other. It's just a consistency that runs from before the war to after the war. That we need rules, and yes, we like rules because we need them, and that enables us to sustain things. But just one quick caveat: if one that favourite old of some people at least British comedy Dad's Army set in the Second World War. You know, Jimmy Perry wrote a very specific character of whose name I now can't remember, but the Spiv. And the Spiv in the Second World War was a kind of folk devil, a very clear character. What he symbolized was all those people who didn't abide by the rules during the war, the black marketeers, all the people who were ducking and diving. So it's important not to get sort of, despite all my optimism, too rose-tinted about everything.
So what do you hope that people take from Audley Britain?
What I hope they would take from it is two things. I hope that they would look at the everyday and see everyday stuff around them, whether it be, you know, picking up after dogs or your example of shopping trolleys or, you know, all the things, the mundane, the banal, the apparently everyday. And look at those things with slightly fresh eyes and just ask a question about them. What do those things tell us about, you know, Manchester or Marbella? What is it about them that makes them interesting? And indeed, are they interesting? And the second thing I'd like them to take from the book is a sense of optimism. Let's be critical of the things that it's right to be critical of, and it's important that we worry about. But beyond that, let's celebrate actually what's good and positive about us. And one of those things is our self-control and our regulation and our orderliness.
So there you go. And down with miserabilism, I think, Tim.
Absolutely.
Well, the book is called Audley Britain, How Britain Has Resolved Everyday Problems from Dog Fouling to Double Parking. It's by Tim Newman and Andrew Ward. You can form an Audley queue if you wish to buy it. Do you see what I did there? Or you can get it online from our online bookstore. But where can people find you online, Tim?
So people can find me online on Twitter at Tim Newburn, but also I'm contactable via email as well. If anyone sticks my name into Google, they'll be able to get hold of me, and I'm very happy to engage in conversation about the book.
The book is called Audley Britain. It's by Tim Newburn, who we speak to today, and Andrew Ward. Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.